All right. Y'all ready to get started? All right, if you call the case.
Court will now call in the interest of a child. Mr. Paul Winnetke will argue for the appellant B.D. and J.D. Mr. Thomas Michelle will argue for the appellee at the Gluttony Center for Adoption.
Excuse me. May it please the court. Paul Winnetke here, representing the birth parents, which is how I'm going to refer to them, in this appeal of the summary judgment, which prematurely terminated their bill of review proceeding by which they were attempting to overturn the termination of their parental rights based on the fact that their signatures on both the affidavits of voluntary relinquishment and the proposed judgment were procured by fraudulent misrepresentations. So this is not an appeal or direct appeal of a termination. This is an appeal from a summary judgment, and therefore the standards of review for this court are going to be the familiar summary judgment standards of review. Now, in preparing this oral argument and reviewing this case over the past few days, it occurred to me that there are three overriding questions that kind of flow through this case, and it might be helpful to the court to try to keep these in mind as it is deciding this case. The first question is a signature on a document that was procured by fraudulent inducement of any legal effect for any purpose? And we believe the answer to that is no. The second question, can a bill of review defendant, by an early filed motion to dismiss or motion for summary judgment, ask a trial court to decide a dispositive issue before trial that the Texas Supreme Court has repeatedly stated and consistently stated is to be only decided on the final trial on the merits of the bill of review to a jury if necessary? And number three, under circumstances such as these where you have pro se litigants and their state of mind is at issue, should the pro se litigant be held to have the same knowledge base as a practicing attorney who deals with these issues every day? And again, we believe the answer to that question is no. And in support of that, we've cited two cases in our original brief, Wheeler versus Green and N. Ray KML, both from the Texas Supreme Court, one just from this past year. So I'll start here where we started below. A motion to dismiss is not a proper procedural vehicle to attack a bill of review on an issue that has been reserved for the final trial of that bill of review. Neither is a motion for summary judgment a proper vehicle to attack a bill of review on an issue that is to be decided at the final trial of the bill of review.
Well, what issue are you saying is to be decided at the final trial?
Those issues are notice that the judgment has been entered and whether the bill of review plaintiff was negligent or exercised due diligence in finding out about the judgment and in exercising legal remedies that were available to them before the time for that expired.
Well, doesn't the plaintiff bear the burden of establishing those elements in order to attain a bill of review?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so it's just like any other claim. The plaintiff bears the burden of proof on the elements of their claim, so why is summary judgment not appropriate?
Because the Supreme Court and courts of appeals have repeatedly stated that the only pretrial hearing that you should have in a bill of review is the one to decide whether the plaintiff has a meritorious defense. And whether they were prevented from presenting that defense by the fraud, official mistake, or some other unlawful conduct, and whether they were negligent in not discovering the judgment had been entered, those are issues that are to be decided on final trial. That is from Baker versus Goldsmith right up to the present.
Well, I believe the Supreme Court just issued an opinion in Katie Venture that was a summary judgment in a bill of review proceeding concerning notice.
Okay. Well, forgive me, I'm not familiar with that one. I will go and read it. But even if the court cannot rest its opinion on that particular ground, we have several other solid grounds for reversal in this case. So it is our position, and there is no evidence, as a matter of fact, that the birth parents ever had notice that the judgment was signed until the adoptive parents definitively cut off contact between the birth parents and their child. The appellees have argued below and still argue here that the simple fact that the birth parents signed the proposed judgment of termination is all that it takes. That then puts them on continual inquiry as to whether, when and whether a judgment has been signed and on pain of waiving their rights if they don't get a motion for a new trial on file within the time allowed by law. But it's important to note, when you're considering the appellee's argument, they claim that the birth mother's affidavit undercuts her position, that almost immediately she began seeing that the adoptive parents weren't going to do what they said they would. But I would submit to you that until the adoptive parents definitively cut off contact, there wasn't a completed fraud, if you will. They didn't have a live cause of action. It would be as if you and I entered into a contract, and before the time for my performance arrived, I started saying, you know, I've got misgivings about this. I'm not sure I can do this. I'm not sure I can do it the way that I said I would do it. You don't have a cause of action for breach of contract at that point. It's only when I definitively fail to reform or absolutely announce that I'm not going to perform that you have a breach of contract claim. And I think the same general idea applies here. Until those adoptive parents formally cut off contact, there was still hope of making the thing work. And they really didn't even have a ripe cause of action. The GLADDY people have devoted a lot of argument to the intricacies of Rule 306A of the Texas Rule of Civil Procedure and how that extends the deadlines for motion for a new trial if one does not get notice that the judgment or other appealable order has been signed. It's our contention that 306A doesn't even come into play in this case, and here's why. Rule 306A expressly contemplates or expressly requires the clerk to send a notice of any appealable order to all parties and or their attorneys. In this case, and in other cases governed by Family Code 161.209, where you've signed a affidavit of voluntary relinquishment and a proposed judgment, you don't get notice. So a rule that depends on a party getting notice or depends on a requirement that a party is supposed to get notice simply is not going to apply in a case where that rule has been waived. So all of the arguments about having until or February of 2014 to do something are simply out the window. The order of termination was signed on October the 9th. Therefore, the deadline was November the 8th, period. On that day, the birth parents were happily preparing for their trip to go and spend the Thanksgiving holidays with the adoptive parents and with their child, as they had agreed to do. And nothing until the very end of that trip even started giving them an intimation that things were going to go south. Things did not go south for another 2 months. Since we are talking summary judgment, there are genuine issues of material fact in this case which should have precluded that summary judgment. We have discussed several cases in our brief in which promises and inducements and agreements have been made or given to the birth parent to induce that birth parent to voluntarily terminate their parental rights. And when those representations turned out to be false, the courts have said that question, whether there was fraud in the inducement of the signatures on those affidavits or on that agreed judgment or proposed judgment, that question in and of itself presents a genuine issue of material fact and precludes summary judgment. We have that in 3 or 4 termination cases cited in our brief and in the Marriage of Ham case, which is a very important analog in this particular situation.
Those cases merely say that under the facts of those cases, there was a fact issue that should go to the jury or the fact finder, or does it say that those cases go as broadly as you would suggest and say that in every case where it is alleged, it must go to the fact finder?
I did not see a statement as broad or sweeping as that.
Because it seems to me that while you might plead it, under a certain set of circumstances, you might just, a party might just say, well, although they've pled it, I wasn't really defrauded. In that case, it would be ripe for summary judgment.
Well,
because of a judicial admission, an admission against interest.
Well, and that could be, but that didn't happen in this case.
I know, but you're trying to say that this always, always, always goes to the fact finder. And I don't read those cases to say that it always goes.
Well, and I don't read them that broadly either, Your Honor. But in those cases, there was evidence very, very similar to the evidence presented by the birth parents in this case about the conduct of either the adoption agency or the respective parents or both that led them to sign that affidavit when they would not have signed had they known the true facts. And that is exactly what we have in this case. Another material question is whether and when the parents had notice of the judgment. That also should be a genuine issue of material fact, which should have precluded summary judgments. And again, there is no evidence in this record that the birth parents had any idea of legal procedures, motions for a new trial, deadlines for filing them, Rule 306A. Now, I'll be the first to agree, we cannot have two different rules of procedure, one for lawyers and one for pro se litigants. Nobody wants that for a variety of good reasons. But as stated by the Supreme Court in Wheeler versus Green, where the rule itself depends upon the state of mind of that party, and the state of mind of our birth mother is of vital importance in this case, then you have to recognize that and make allowances for it.
What element are you saying depends on the state of mind of the birth mother?
Whether she was negligent or whether she exercised diligence in finding out.
I believe that's an objective standard, not a subjective standard.
Well, that may be, Your Honor. But I still believe you have to nevertheless consider that in making your objective determination of whether she was negligent or not, or whether she exercised adequate diligence or not. Because it simply is not realistic, in addition, it's not fair, to hold a pro se party to have the same body of knowledge that a practicing attorney would have on the top of his head. In addition to the genuine issues of material fact, basically, we believe that there's no evidence, or certainly factually insufficient evidence, to support that motion for summary judgment. And here we have, again, we go back to the marriage of Ham situation. It was not filed as a motion for summary judgment. It was not set up as a motion for summary judgment. There's no affidavits attached to verify any of the statements made in it. There is one piece of, quote, evidence attached to it, and that is a certified copy of the judgment that does bear the signatures of the birth parents. But it is our contention those signatures were obtained by fraud and should be of no effect. Even if you give them effect, all you have is a judgment. That doesn't prove the grounds asserted in the Gladney's motion for summary judgment. Again, I will redirect your attention to the standards of review in a summary judgment case. All evidence favorable to the non-movement, which is the birth parents, must be taken as true. All conflicts in the evidence, all reasonable inferences are made in favor of the non-movement, the birth parents. It is up to the movement for summary judgment, Gladney, to establish independently its right to judgment as a matter of law and to establish there is no genuine issue of material fact. And the non-movements are not required to do anything unless and until the movements make that showing. They did not make that showing in this case. Finally, we do make a due process argument, again, based on our interpretation of the cases that say that the issues of negligence or diligence of the Bill of Review plaintiff should be reserved for final trial on the merits with a proper fact finder rather than being resolved prematurely by summary judgment. We believe that that is not only an improper procedure under the Texas Supreme Court precedents on this matter, but that it also is a denial of their due process rights. And those due process rights are especially important in cases which touch or concern a termination of parental rights. And that, I believe, concludes my argument.
Thank you. Thomas?
May it please the court. Nice to see you all this afternoon. Justice Walker, you're correct, it is an objective standard. Justice Sutterth, you're correct, it is a standard summary judgment in which you got to create a fact issue as in any other type of. I'm fighting the exact same battle, but on his side, and I'm having to face those same summary judgment burdens as he faces here this afternoon. In this case, the record was undisputed that a judgment was entered and that it was not timely attacked by a motion for a new trial, or by restricted appeal. Those facts are undisputed and uncontested before the court. The appellants try to come in and try to say some excuse for some reason why they did not file it. The issue presented before the court is squarely before it is they had signed an agreed judgment, and that somehow they were not on notice that by signing an agreed judgment, that an agreed judgment would be entered. The standard is a person who knew or by the exercise of ordinary prudence could have known of the judgment. And that, in other words, are they fairly put on notice? In this case, they signed a judgment. They signed an affidavit of relinquishment. Therefore, unlike the Maybon case, this is a case where they literally signed the document that was going to be entered by the trial court. If that doesn't, as a matter of law, put you on notice that a judgment is going to be entered, I'm not sure what else would. Secondly, the issue of the affidavit that they tried to create a fact question on as to try to explain why absolutely undercuts their very argument. And I think there's three arguments that support that. Number one, immediately after signing the affidavit or relinquishment, the appellant was on notice, said that she knew that there, something had been wrong. And we quoted that in her affidavits, paragraphs 22 and 23. She stated quite succinctly that almost immediately she was knew that there was an issue with the that the were not holding up their promises, and that they were continued on with that, and that's found as clerk's records, page 71 and 72. And they also said, we knew about it, and we would have signed if we had known. We would have signed. We would have done something about signing a revocation. We would have revoked our consent in a heartbeat. So she knew immediately that something was up, which is, once again, are you on fair notice that something has been done? Number two, I think 306A4 does come into play. In their response to the motion for summary judgment, they indicated that the time deadline, which I think is properly correct, is November the 28th, because that would be the timeline from when the nunc-pro-tunc was signed. But I was trying to be the most cautious. If we start even from the date the judgment was signed on October 6th forward, or if you take the nunc-pro-tunc, that takes you to November 28th. In any event, under the first prong, they immediately knew. Second, they were granted, I believe, a fair reading of Rule 306A4 is designed to address a situation. Number one, 306A4 has two components to it. One is that if the clerk sends out notice, but B, it has the additional provision, or if you receive actual notice, which is kind of a belt and suspenders. I've done, just from my practice, I've had to come in and do a number of 306A4 motions, and one thing you always do when you're talking to usually trial counsel, you may have not gotten notice, but did you know about it somehow? And so there's two components to that, or actual notice, which is not addressed at all in the appellant's brief. In that situation, that would take the time out, as appellant's counsel has said, till February. And by all accounts, their affidavit is replete with having met with lawyers, looking at it, and seeing what they had to do. And in fact, by the time they met with lawyers, the Kuhn-Fuller's firm in December, they thought they still had additional time under the not having received notice, presumably. And third, a third reason why it's also, believe, an improper motion and an improper appeal is that they made the conscious choice not to attack it. They were there. They knew almost immediately. They decided to think about it, but they didn't want to rock the boat. They wanted to try to work out and see if they could get more visitation with the adoptive parents. But once again, we cited cases on that. When you, under the most lenient standard, which is obviously the motion for extension of time when you miss the deadline to file a timely brief in the Court of Appeals, is even negligence will qualify to get an extension of time. Unless, in those rare cases where they come up, is where people consciously decide, you know, well, I'm not sure if we want to appeal. Let's see how this works out. And then we decided some event happened. We're not really sure. You know what? Maybe we better appeal. And then they put in their motion why they didn't file their extension of time timely. Well, that's kind of what gets you on those, is because that's a conscious choice. You made a conscious decision not to attack the underlying judgment.
And doesn't the birth mother's affidavit also indicate that she was told before she signed the paperwork that the agreement concerning the contact she would have with her child was not enforceable?
Yes. I mean, all of those grounds. That goes to, I think, even the merits of their case, but she was fully advised of those things. Her own affidavit states that, and for all of those grounds, we believe Judge Wells did the right thing. I think she did a good job of being presented with any. I think she probably could have proceeded correctly the way they were going, but managing your trial docket, sometimes you can get things wrapped up nicely so you can reduce any risk of error. She granted the challengers to the underlying judgment additional time to conduct discovery, to retool, to get affidavits, and to file an amended response, all in an attempt, which is a nice way to give them their attempt in their day in court, so that if the case should go up, it would be those procedural hiccups, if any, would have been resolved. Thank you, and we request that the court affirm the judgment.
Thank you. Paul, is there rebuttal?
I'd like to hit that last point. I would like to hit that last point first, if I may, if I can speak properly. Yes, the birth mother was told before she signed the affidavit of voluntary relinquishment and the proposed judgment that the contact agreement, which she had worked on so hard with the agency and the birth parents, was not legally binding or enforceable. But that was at the very last minute. She was not given these documents beforehand to go home and review and figure it out for herself. As a matter of fact, her affidavit contains a rather detailed description of what a distraught mental state she was in at the time that she arrived at the Gladney offices to sign that affidavit. She wouldn't even go inside the building until she had called the prospective adoptive mother and had a heart-to-heart and received assurances that that contact agreement would be honored and would be abided by. And that was the only reason she went inside and signed those documents. But it was at the time that she pulled up and walked into Gladney and they presented her with these documents that had the full and final language in them that lawyers are familiar with, but new mothers are not, that she realized that the agreement was not going to be enforceable and that the termination was final and irrevocable. And for whatever reason, again, she's testified in her affidavit to the mental state that she was laboring under at the time. She went ahead and signed the documents and hoped for the best, and the best turned to the worst for her. Also, the argument that meeting with lawyers somehow would have given her an indication that a judgment would have been signed and that time was running, I would submit to you, if she's meeting with lawyers and lawyers are advising her about the case and telling her, hey, we got a little bit more time, lawyers that she's hired, she's relying on her lawyer's advice at that point. She no longer has an independent duty to run down to the courthouse and see if a judgment's been signed, and if so, when. She's consulting legal professionals whose sole job is to do just exactly that. We would disagree vigorously with the argument that the statements in that affidavit that immediately after signing the adoptive parents left when they had originally been going to stay, that doesn't put you on notice that the entire agreement's not going to be abided by. Matter of fact, as far as I know, that provision was not even in the agreement. That was a policy decision that Gladney officials had made or had suggested, and it wasn't complied with. But again, if you look at the cases we have cited in our brief, Vela versus Marywood, Queen versus Getters, Rogers versus Searle, in none of those cases was the fraud discovered until the adoptive parents dropped the hammer and said no more contact, or no contact at all from the beginning. Until that happens, you don't know that that agreement is not going to be kept, and you don't know that the signature that you put on those papers in return for that agreement was in fact procured by fraud.
But you understand the policy ramifications of your argument. Under your argument you just made, 5 years after an adoption, someone could say, well, now they're not letting me see my child anymore, so my signature was induced by fraud on
Your Honor, we've got 6 months to file a bill of review under the family code provision, and that is, as far as I understand, is a hard deadline. I do recognize the real life ramifications if this court does reverse and remand this case and if the bill of review is granted. It is a very difficult human situation. There's a discussion in one of the cases that we have cited in our brief, and it may be by the Supreme Court, I'm not sure, of the fact that, well, yeah, we realize that the child has been with another set of parents for all this time, and it's going to be a terrible thing for them to give him up. But that's not the adoptive or the birth mother's fault. That is primarily the fault of the justice system and the fact that the wheels turn slowly. But again, I would remind you, the case that you're reviewing today is not whether that termination should stand. The case you're reviewing today is, should the birth parents have the opportunity to have their day in court and see if Judge Wells will sustain or reverse herself on the judgment terminating the parental rights. That's all we're asking, is a day in court. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate your argument. Your case is submitted. You're free to go about your business, and this court will be adjourned.